Nu, willkommen. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. Those who are new today and those who have been coming for a long time, we welcome you to our fellowship. We are a church without a creed, without dogma. However, we do affirm the seven principles that are written on the back of the programs that you all have. Are there any guests or any new members or people? Please, well, introduce yourself. Thank you. See? Any other guests or new visitors? Or not so new visitors? Well, all are welcome. Our children, in their religious education classes this year, in addition to canoe trips, camping, and maintaining the garden outside that window, which you could see if the blinds weren't drawn, are embarked on virtual world tours as part of the World Traveler Program. These world travels come from our members who are sharing their own adventures with the RE classes to such exotic places as Hawaii and Pillsbury Crossing. We welcome you to share in these world travels as we hear from both our young UUs this morning and from slightly older UUs, from guests sharing their Sunday with us this morning, and hopefully from your own stories. We hope all of our eyes are opened to these stories and tales, and all come away with a sense of belonging to a global family. We would now like to light the chalice to open our service. We light this flame, we light this chalice, and we let it burn openly to represent our free and responsible search for truth and for meaning. This morning, we especially light this chalice in the spirit of world community, with peace, liberty, and justice for all. We'd now like to open our service with a song, number 318. Dick Beeman will be leading us. Pat, are you here to provide some harmony? This is hymn number 318 in the hymnal, We Would Be One. So please stand as you are able and join us in the singing of We Would Be One.
We're going to try something new and sing this spiritedly.
We would be one as now we join in singing our hymn of love.
Thank you very much, Dick and Pat, and all of you, especially for the lively rendition of the song. I almost saw some people swaying in that, so that's the next step. This is the time of the service when we welcome any joys that you may wish to share with the congregation or any sorrows or concerns as well. So please. Doug has the microphone.
My name is Sabrina Boker. I got concerned. My nephew is in the hospital. He was playing on riding on his bike, and he fell, and he hit a corner of a raised patio, and it damaged his spleen. But they said he would be, it just lacerated. But he said, as long as he rests for the next month, he should be okay. So.
Hi, Aaron Ford. It's a joy to be back and to see you all, to be in the country again from a break from New York City, which has been a great year for me. So I'll look forward to talking to you afterwards.
I have two joys. One of them is it's Nick's birthday. And the second joy is that I'm back from a long vacation at my grandma's.
Well, Buddy and I are happy to be here today. About 3.5 weeks ago, you probably heard he suffered a stroke. He's doing really hard work in rehab and making good progress, so we're glad to be here. And, of course, our other celebration is Nick's birthday.
I have one joy. A lightning hit our favorite tree. It's almost split right in the middle.
Bryce Hobrock, thanks to those of you who attended my mother's memorial service a week ago yesterday, even though it was 3 hours distant. And thank you all for the cards and letters that we received regarding her passing.
Thank you for all who have shared your joys and your concerns, and for those joys and concerns kept close to your heart. Please know that we are with you. Many of you might have heard of the flipped classroom. Well, we're going to try something a bit similar this morning with respect to a flipped children for our children's story. Instead of having one of us old people tell a story to the children, Lily is going to share with us a story of the World Traveler Program. So, Lily, the floor is yours.
And kids are welcome to come up for this. Littlest kids.
Or big kids.
Hey everyone. So as Dave explained, my name is Lily Colburn. I'm Sandy's daughter. Today the adults are talking about benefits of travel, and I was asked to share one of my own experiences with you. So now we all know about how we go on trips in RE in the summer, right? Do you guys remember that? Yeah, and they're lots of fun, aren't they? Well, we started that program in 2005 when I was 5 years old. And Jake, how old are you? You're five? So I was Jake's age. And
I'm five.
You're five too, Ryder? So Jake and Ryder are how old I was. And my mom was really excited. She kept talking about how our first trip was going to be to Australia. She got lots of books and lots of maps from the library. And in my head, the whole time, I was thinking, I don't think we can do this, Mom. I don't think we should go to Australia. She said, no, 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 it'll be fine, don't worry. It will be lots of fun. Thinking, no, it's not going to be, Mom. She just said, no, it'll be fine, you'll see. And the rest of the week, I kept reminding her, I don't think we should go to Australia. And she kept saying, it'll be okay. So Sunday morning rolls around, and I finally look her in the eye and say, Mom, we can't go to Australia. RE is only 1 hour long, and it takes 2 hours to get to the airport. Let alone the 15-hour plane ride. I was 5 years old at the time. And she explained to me what we were going to do and how it was only in our imagination. And it turned out that it was lots of fun, and we learned lots about Australia and lots about animals that live there. And since that summer, we've gone on lots of trips. We've gone to Germany, we've gone to Italy, we've gone to San Francisco. I've led a trip to Europe, and we've even gone to the Milky Way galaxy when we learned our address, which I don't remember either. And we've learned a lot about traveling to different places. But one of the most important things that I've learned was when you travel for real or just in RE, you never know what might happen, so you always have to keep an open mind.
Everywhere you may go. Thank you, Lily. That was wonderful. And enjoy your travels this morning, wherever you may be going. This is now when we get to share our blessings with those in the fellowship through the offertory. Mark Twain wrote in the conclusions to Innocents Abroad, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, and charitable views on men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one's little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." Keeping with the flavor of Mark Twain's observations on the travels that he undertook in Innocents Abroad, we have three speakers this morning. One is a graduate student here from India who works with Amber Priyana. Amber will be speaking, and then I'll be bringing the subject to a close, or actually more to an opening to hear of your own adventures abroad. So, Priyana, you're first.
Good morning. When I decided to move to America, thank you. I thought it'll be an easy transition because I grew up in Mumbai, which is a cosmopolitan town. You can't not be multicultural there. I was fed a daily diet of American television, so I get it, right? American culture. I understand the slang. I'm well-traveled. No problems. And then I get here, and everything falls apart. I realized that so much of the challenges that I was experiencing when I first moved here was because I was judging everything by my own yardstick. Everything around me looked different, and it looked ridiculous to me because it was different. And even though I had learned about ethnocentrism in undergrad, in a sociology class, it was very different living it, because so much dissatisfaction came from when things looked different. And some of my challenges were also coming from the fact that a lot of people in India, when they move to a Western country, they give up so much of themselves to assimilate everything around them. They reject everything that they believe, everything that comes from their origin and roots, to assimilate everything that's different. And I didn't want to be that, so I ended up being on this end of the continuum where everything different from me was bad. As I started adjusting and settling here, I came face to face with my own ethnocentrism, and I realized that to be truly open-minded is to realize that A, I was ethnocentric, and B, maybe beginning to open my mind a little bit up to see just because things were different didn't mean that they were bad. So that was my journey, really, when I moved here. I also realized that even though I had traveled a lot before and I had spent a month abroad, weeks in different countries, living in a foreign country and making it your home was very different, very, very different. And that's why I had not experienced any of the same challenges when I traveled before, but I did when I actually tried to make America my home. Realizing that I was biased and prejudiced was quite a shock to me, because I considered that I was quite liberal and open-minded. So I had to do a lot of self-reflection to figure out where some of my beliefs were coming from. And I realized that had I not moved, I would have gone through my whole life thinking, I'm so liberal, I'm so open-minded, and I would have never been challenged and forced to recognize that we're all prone to ethnocentrism, but the strength comes from when somebody really challenges you and shows you a mirror, is recognizing it and becoming aware of it. So that's been my journey, and thank you for having me today so I could share it with you.
And as one of Prerna's faculty, I asked her to speak today because she is so open and insightful about that journey she's had. And I think it's also really opened my eyes to assumptions I had about if you're coming to America, what that means and what assumptions people bring with them. So that's been really helpful for my own growth process. So I first went abroad in high school, and it was only for a couple of weeks. I went to, you know, kind of some European countries. I was as part of a Madrigal trip, I was a singer, and we just toured around and sang, and it was great, and I had all these fun cultural experiences, but it was like a guided thing, you know, we're going around. I had never really fully immersed somewhere. When I was a senior in college, I had been going through some pretty significant life changes, and I said, I just want to go for it. I just want to keep changing. I just want to grow. I just want to put both feet in. and I told my family this, and they reacted with some very different, unexpected reactions. My grandmother, who's very conservative, said, you're not going to become one of those bra-burning hippies, are you? And I didn't really understand what bra-burning had to do with traveling. So I just kind of brushed that aside. I don't know what she's talking about, and went on. My dad's reaction was so the place I chose, I should tell you that first, the place I chose to go was India, Nepal, and Tibet. I did a Tibetan studies program, not because I knew a lot about Tibetans and wanted to know more, the opposite, actually. I didn't know anything about Tibetans. And I said, well, that would be the biggest chance for growth I could get, right? So I'm going to go somewhere I have no experience in, with no idea what I'm getting into, and that was my jump. So I told my dad this, and he says, he's evangelical free Christian. He said, well, you know, Amber, that technology now, it was 2003, so the internet had been around a couple years now, right? In most places. Because of technology, the word of God will have reached almost everywhere. So the apocalypse is going to be happening soon. Okay, I'm not sure how that was relevant either to one of my travel. I'm like, is it going to happen when I'm there? I don't know what you're trying to tell me. I think both of those from my grandmother and my father were trying to say, don't be too swayed by what you see. Stay with our culture. Stay here. Stay with this. Even though you're going there, don't let yourself be influenced too much. Well, they didn't have a hope that, I mean, I was going to change, and I changed dramatically. The hardest thing about figuring out what to say today was that I think I could talk for entire days on how it changed my life and my perspective. And so I'm going to try and narrow it down. Just tell a couple ways it did. And one is in reaction to my dad's comments. So I landed in India, and culture shock set in, and there were many, many revelations that I had. And I wasn't too pushed at that point. There was a Catholic or Christian church in the town that I was in India. I thought, okay, well, it seems kind of odd here, but I guess that'll work. And then we went to Nepal, and then we went to Tibet. And in Tibet, we had been studying Buddhism, and I get to Tibet, and I'm looking at the vastness of the landscape, the giant mountains. I can't even describe what the sky looks like at that altitude. It's purple and gray and so wide open. The top of the world doesn't even really encompass what you feel up there. It's amazingly breathtaking. And to know that, you know, Tibetans, their culture was created in that context. The top of the world, there's no water, there's no trees, it is all rocks. Everywhere you look, and mountains, and valleys, and just openness. There is nothing there. Their houses are made out of cow poop that they form into bricks from the yaks, so yak dung, and that's what they use for fuel. What they drink is yak milk. What they eat is yak, and they leave it outside their houses, and it rots, and they consider that seasoning. Their clothes are made from yak wool. So going to Tibet and thinking of what my dad had said suddenly, and I had been raised Christian. I was already starting to question some of my beliefs at that time. I just remember thinking, "This, but that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense that they, if I came here and I talked to them about Christianity, they would look at me like I was insane, because that wouldn't make sense in this context. In this context, that wouldn't help them explain their lives and what's happening and how to make meaning out of what they're witnessing. That religion wasn't created here. It doesn't, I don't know that it would help explain and make meaning out of their life. And I think for a lot of us, that's what religion and spirituality does. Not for all of us, but for a lot of us, we use it that way. And that was my first real bump of understanding maybe the role religion serves in a lot of people's lives and maybe how that might look different around the world. And that where I was from, that was a very narrow cultural view, and there was some ethnocentrism in my views in going abroad. So that was my first big bump and part of what led me to be a UU. So that continued my spiritual progression. Was thinking, maybe evangelizing, maybe we need to understand context. Maybe that's really important. Environmental context, even, and how that shapes culture. One of the other big bumps I had was, so when I got to India, they have no trash system in the places that I was at. There's no, like, garbage is everywhere. That's my son. He's talking back to me. There's garbage everywhere in Nepal and Tibet, same. I mean, garbage is just on the road and it's around you, and there's a lot of animal feces around. In the places I was anyway, there was. And I stayed with a family, and they lived in a one-bedroom, I wouldn't call it a house, like a concrete room that was part of a bunch of units, kind of almost like an apartment building, but you come in at different entrances. I stayed with that family. There was one room, and there were three beds in that room. There was mom, dad, brother, sister. So dad slept with brother, mom slept with sister, and I got the third bed. And I actually felt quite guilty that I got the third bed. So during the day, they put rugs over the beds, and they were couches during the day. And at night, they would take the rugs off and put blankets and sheets down, and then they were beds. And there was a tiny little kitchen. She didn't have electricity. She cooked with fire. My amala, that's Tibetan for mother. my amala cooked in a big wok. And when I left to go to Nepal and Tibet, we started in India, Nepal, Tibet, Nepal, India, Nepal. We got around a lot. I thought, you know, actually I was quite happy there. It was quite nice not to worry about what I was wearing each day. I was living out of a backpack. That's all we could bring. I showered maybe once a week. I went to the bathroom outdoors. Traveling wasn't a big deal, because if you go on a trip and you have to go to the bathroom, you don't have to find a bathroom. The world is your bathroom. So you just find a bush or a hill or hold something up in front of you. I realized that my ideas of what good living is or what it means to be happy in life were very culturally based. That, you know, living in one room in America has a very different connotation than it did there. That if I live in one room here, what does that mean? Like, that's my whole house and all of my family sleeps with me in the same room, and, you know, what images does that bring to mind in America? Versus over there, it was completely normal. And they were not unhappy about it, because that's how everybody lived, that they knew around them. And as I lived there with them, I was happy with that. And I was happy to not take a shower every day. At first, I thought it was super gross, and I was worried about how my hair would look and all of those kinds of things, but I just put bandanas on, and I looked cute anyway. I also noticed the influence of Western values. So the Tibetans in exile, the head of Tibetan government in exile is in Dharamsala, India. That is where the Dalai Lama lives now, since they evacuated from Tibet. And the adults were complaining a lot of the influence of Western ideas and cultures and how that was impacting their teenagers. And their teenagers wanted to wear blue jeans, and they all wanted to leave. They felt like that this place was crap, and what they were doing was crap, and they needed more opportunities, and they needed to get out there, and they needed to live more like Westerners live, that was good, and what they were living in was not good. And the elders did not share that view. The elders felt, no, we value our history, we value our culture. We do these things for a certain reason. There are reasons we do what we do, that they had that culture they brought with them from Tibet when they exiled, but the adolescents didn't remember being in Tibet. They only remembered being in India and watching TV and watching Dallas. They watched that a lot. There was a lot of Dallas on TV. I don't know why that specific one. Soap opera made it so famous abroad, but everything was about Dallas. So they see that and they say, that is what's good. That's what's good. Not me. I'm not good anymore because I'm comparing myself to that image. America, that view is what's good. And I am no longer good. And that was really sad to hear. When I was there, there was a huge movement talking to teenagers. They all wanted to leave. They all wanted to go. And to me, discovering Tibetan culture, I found so many similarities to Midwestern culture. They're funny. They joke a lot to cope with very hard, hard things. They slap each other on the butts and and joke. And I fell in love with their culture, and it was sad to me. It was sad to me that you could see the adolescents rejecting that in preference of Western ideas, and they saw Britney Spears' music videos. And I'm sure that a lot of us would not want that to be the representation of what America would be, would be Britney Spears' videos and Dallas. But that's what a lot of them were seeing, and that's what a lot of them were then idolizing. So America's good. That's where you go to be wealthy, and that's what you look like, and you live in, many bedroom homes, and now this one room that we're living in is not good anymore. Now it's bad. But before it was good, before they knew that American culture would consider it bad. So the lesson I learned from that was that what I consider good and bad, and what I consider, I think we all do it. We judge ourselves on are we succeeding in life? Are we doing well? How we gauge that is totally culturally based. Am I doing well? In India, I was doing well. A lot of that was simply because I was beautiful because I had light skin, and that was considered beautiful there. And here, my light skin I got teased a lot for. But then here it's considered good if I work and I make a lot of money and I live in a really big house and I drive a really fancy car. And, culture shapes our value system and how we judge ourselves. And I guess so the biggest lesson I learned was not to judge others by my own value system or even by what the dominant culture says is good and bad. Even within America, there is a huge variety of cultures. And for me to say, well, that's bad, before I really understand that culture, to me, is not fair. That's short-sighted. There is no one, definition of good. It all depends on the cultural context. So there are two of the big lessons I learned, and I try and keep those with me. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes I think, I really do need that pair of shoes. I would really look much better if I had that sixth pair of shoes. maybe we need four bedrooms in our house. I think three might not be cutting it. Maybe we really need four. That would be best. So every couple years, I try and go to a different culture and spend some time there to reground myself and to really remember, to me, what's important. It's not that I have to adopt their cultural views or give up my own. It just challenged me to evaluate, am I doing this because other people are saying this is good, or is this what I think is good? Is this what I want to define for myself as valuable for my life and for what I want to do and for my family? So when I feel myself self-strain, I take a trip. And then I'm like, oh, right. So that helps. Thank you.
Thank you, Priyana and Amber. I am shocked, just totally shocked, that American culture is not represented by Dallas. I did not guess that. Building a service this morning around the RE's World Traveler Program seemed like such a good idea 2 months ago. But as this morning approached, I found myself growing more and more distant from my comfort zone. Both Amber and Priyana have done a wonderful job in transporting us both to and from India, Nepal, and Tibet, sharing their experiences. Many of you in this room also have had international experiences, and we will be asking you to share those with us shortly. My own experiences pale somewhat in comparison to those of yours and the ones we've heard of this morning. I have traveled, and I have lived in different countries, in Europe and in Central America and in Asia. But rather than stepping outside of my comfort zone, perhaps because I have traveled so much, I carry my comfort zone with me. I'm not certain that I have developed Twain's broad, wholesome, and charitable views on men and things, but because of my experiences and how easy it is to actually travel, I do not feel myself to be a citizen of Kansas or even of the United States. I have felt at home in many countries, just as I have felt to be an outsider close to Manhattan and elsewhere in the world. Despite safely within my comfort zone when I travel, I don't have a Pollyannish view of the world. There are many horrible things in the world. Horrible things are occurring in Egypt, Syria, Afghanistan. But there are also many horrible things occurring in Kansas. But, and here's the bright side of the talk, there's also beauty in places we have traveled to, both in search of beauty and in those places which we accidentally stumble upon in our travels. So what is the value of world travel? Amber kind of alluded to that in her closing remarks. Whenever she feels closed in, she travels. Well, for me, it is not a quest for the horrible things that are occurring in the world, but I have developed a good sense of when to ease myself away from threatening situations or from large, angry crowds, which I have done in the past. No, for me, the value of travel is to expand my perception of what is considered here back home to be the right way of doing things. I can go into a lot of details of the travels and the places I've lived, but just a few snippets of the experiences I have experienced, and I can go into details if anyone cares to catch me at coffee outside afterwards, but some of these have burned themselves forever into my own view of the world. I recall Christmas services at the old church on the Domplatz in Amsterdam. I recall hitchhiking through Switzerland in the cold and in a horrible snowstorm. I remember an accidental, because we just stumbled upon it, invitation to a large, multi-generational family gathering down a few steps into a basement off of the Ramblas in Barcelona one New Year's Eve. I was traveling with three young American co-eds at the time and myself. I don't think we were invited because I was there. And then I've had many, many experiences of passing through borders, from the former communist countries of Europe through the TSA checkpoints at Manhattan International. I have embraced a few lessons from these experiences. Again, I'll go into details if anyone cares, but one lesson I've taken away is to clap and to sing when the Spirit is with you. Another lesson is that sometimes random events catch us up short and force us to redefine ourselves and to redefine our world. And then referring back to the border crossings in Yugoslavia and East Germany and the TSA security checks, uniforms, and a bit of power, either real or imagined, can change people. Being a 21st century kind of guy, I naturally did a little bit of an internet search before or in preparation for this morning's talk. And one site that I found specifically amazing or fascinating was a Unitarian Universalist Partner Church Council. I don't know if any of you have stumbled across this site, but it's the UU Partner Church Council. This council helps facilitate partnerships between UU congregations in the United States and in Canada, and with UUs and Universalists and Unitarian churches around the world. Just kind of as a side note, in case anybody is taking notes, right now there are currently fellowships and churches around the world in Transylvania, Hungary, the Philippines, and Kenya, just to name a few of the countries listed, that are actively seeking partners in the United States or Canada. Posted on this website are reflections and sermons about partnerships and global involvement. The Reverend Roger Bertshausen of the Unitarian Society of Santa Barbara crystallizes for me what is often the result of travel in a sermon that he calls, "Sometimes one must travel far to find what is near." He could have stopped right there because his title says it all. But the title embraces the message that Mr. Bertshausen conveys in the rest of his sermon. Two phrases in the sermon stand out to me. Similar to Amber's experience, but during a study tour in Sri Lanka, Mr. Bertshausen found out deep truths about himself and the future direction his life was to take. He also quotes a character in the book, A Passage to India, in his sermon. In India, one comes face to face with oneself. I could add to these observations that travel not only allows one to discover one's own deep truths, but, and I find this equally important, is how our experiences define or redefine just what these deep truths might be. I opened this morning talking of the RE World Traveler Summer, which are kids, I don't know where they are this morning. As the children hear of others' travels or share their own experiences, we hope that they become enthused with the idea of leaving the comforts of their everyday environments, and they seek a new level of comfort as part of our global family. However, regardless of age, either RE youths or those of us who are a bit more mature, we still search for truth and meaning. Well, mature is probably the wrong word. A bit older. We still search for truth and meaning. We still strive to make this a better world. And we are forever molded as new experiences force us to honestly confront what we imagine is the proper view of the world. So the prepared remarks are finished. We've heard from Purana, we've heard from Amber, and we've heard from me. So please, this is your opportunity to tell us what you have learned in your international travels. And Doug will again circulate with the microphone.
Mickey Ray, this is probably a difference between males and females, too. But I was shocked to find out they don't use washcloths all over the world, which doesn't sound very serious, but it certainly makes you pack one when you go abroad. Also, the idea of the restrooms that she was talking about, that you can't just pop into a restaurant or a shop and say, "May I use your restroom?" Even as a woman, they say, "What? Are you buying something? You know, are you here?" It's been a while since I've been to Europe, but the last time I was there, it just wasn't done. There were public restrooms, which, of course, you don't want to use because they're not clean like American ones are. But I'd like Purana to give us two or three examples of what really surprised her. She mentioned how different it was than what she expected, but give a couple examples of something that really surprised you when you got here. What was unexpected?
I think for me, even though I knew this before I came here, is the lack of public transport. It's something so small but it impacts me on a daily basis. And that's something I take for granted anywhere in India, is that I'm never going to be, if I don't have a car, I'm never going to be stranded. So things like that. Or I can't order milk over the phone. I take that privilege for granted in India because I can't order milk over the phone. So even though a lot of people, I think sometimes there's this difference that we think between the first world and the third world, is that the first world countries have a lot of convenience. And when people think America, they think convenience. But at the same time, because the economy looks different and labor is cheaper in third world, so to speak, third world countries, there are all kinds of conveniences that we take for granted back home. Street food, for example. Corner shops, things like that. So those surprise me that I can't just step out of my house and buy a loaf of bread. I have to go to a Dillon's or a Walmart to do that. So things like that definitely surprise me. Yeah. Yeah, when people socialize, I think the rules for socializing are different. Back home, because we tend to be, it's a more collectivist kind of society, so when I invite people over, I'm expected to provide the food and the drink and things like that, and everybody's a guest. Here, what is nice, and this is, I appreciate that, being a poor student, is that everybody sort of accounts for themselves as far as hosting goes or food goes, and it's a much more, we'll help you clean up, whereas back home, if I'm the host, I'm in charge of everything. How people celebrate holidays here, that's different too. For example, I'm trying to think of Christmas or Easter. Even though the customs are different, the spirit is kind of the same thing, where families get together, and we do that too back home. So that's actually a similarity, not so much a difference. But yeah. Oh, yeah. I think as a student here, my experiences in India and here were pretty different, because in India, there's a big hierarchy between a student and a teacher. So there are certain things that respect is taken for granted. Like here, for me, I would have never thought to eat while a class is going on. And on the first day of class, I see everybody breaking open their snacks and eating and drinking, and I was in shock. But because that would have been seen as a sign of disrespect back home. You don't drink water when class is going on, you don't eat. And similarly, when I would go and visit a faculty member, like if I walk into Amber's office, I would never sit down until she invited me to, because that's a sign of respect, that I stay standing unless you invite me to sit down. And she never realized that I was waiting to be asked. So we would have an hour-long conversation where I would be standing, and she thought I was standing because I like to stand. And I'm waiting... And I'm waiting to be invited to sit down. I would be like, why is she not asking me to sit down? Does she not want me here? So, and if she comes and I'm sitting and she's standing, it's still a really uncomfortable experience for me, because that kind of makes me think that she should be sitting and I should be standing, because that's our role and the respect. So definitely those things are very different. Addressing faculty by their names, we don't do that. Even addressing... people I meet who are much older than me by their name, we don't do that, because that would be seen as disrespect. So I would either, we say auntie or uncle as a generic form of respect, or I might use the last name, but not the first. So yeah, lots of things to get used to.
My name's Marissa Larson. I have lived abroad and traveled abroad, mostly to places that are not that common, all over the Middle East and to the Soviet Union, when it was still Soviet Union, several countries in there. And I guess I'm fortunate in the way that I was raised, and especially from the experience of living abroad as a Peace Corps volunteer, I feel like I've become very comfortable at kind of assimilating myself into whatever culture I'm traveling in. I always make sure to learn some of the language, and most of my travels have been by myself. I'm on my own. I'm not in a group. It's not organized. And so I've learned to just rely on the kindness of the strangers in the countries that I'm traveling in, and they've always come through for me, so that's kind of how I travel now. And last year for work, I traveled to Peru with a coworker and several of our board members, and my eyes were open to a different type of travel that I was not comfortable with, and I was not comfortable with my co-travelers, all of whom had traveled probably to more countries than I had, but always in an organized group. And I got in trouble for interacting with the locals. They treated the trip as if they were going on a week-long, you know, a two-week-long zoo trip. And it was appalling. And I basically almost lost my job because I would leave the group and interact with the locals and talk to people. And they were just like, that is not done. You stay with us and we look at them. We don't talk to them. We view them. And it was just horrible. And I guess I'm wondering, like, I didn't feel like there was anything that I could do because these people were much older than me and they had traveled frequently. So it was just something within themselves that they were not opening themselves up to the experience. And I didn't feel like there was anything I could do or say that would change the way they were, because that's just who they were. The purpose of the trip was to, was to learn about the country and the culture and their agricultural practices, so that we basically were doing a practice trip for then the following year, they were going to take 30 class members to do the similar trip, and we wanted to make sure that we picked out the best things for the students to experience. So I guess as you use, I feel like you guys are all probably kind of like me, and that you're very open-minded when you travel and you like to assimilate yourself in and experience the culture. And I just wanted to share this bizarre experience that I had with this other way that I think a lot of Americans travel that way. And not just Americans. I think a lot of people travel that way. And so I don't think travel is the solution. It's the open-mindedness that is the solution.
Yeah, like I said, you all are going to run the danger of hearing details from me, but similar to your experience, Sybil and our kids, when they were living with us, and I accompanied a group of students we were in North Dakota at the time, to France on a couple of different one-month trips. And one thing I really enjoyed about that was before we left, I asked the students, what prejudice do you have? What is your preconception of how you'll find Europe and the French people? And you know, I got a wide variety of answers back. But then at the end of the trip, I asked the students, okay, here's what you turned in 2, 3, 4 weeks before we left. How have these opinions changed, if they have changed? And for most of them, it was great. Their eyes were opened, and the French were wonderful people, and they loved their country, and da-da-da-da-da. But one of the experiences we had at the very end, which actually turned into a somewhat of an ugly situation, was we had three Americans on the trip, the whole group was much larger than that, who learned nothing. And their response was, I learned nothing. I wish I had never come. The French are horrible people, da-da-da-da-da. And the worst part of that was he left it in his room at the hostel we were staying at in Paris, and the reception guy at the front desk got hold of it, who read it. So I'm not sure I should have. Maybe I shouldn't have. But I went and I talked to him for quite a while about, you know, these people are idiots. You know, most of us had a wonderful time. But, you know, there are people, like you said, who go and are very closed-minded, and they don't learn a darn thing when they travel. As far as the large groups, another experience, when I was younger, a friend and I were backpacking. We were in Dubrovnik, I believe, at the time. And a large group of Americans, like you were describing, came through. And one advantage we had, the two of us, is we were going to school in Germany at the time. So we switched over to German and everything was fine. But we weren't part of that group. So, others.
Yeah. Bryce Hobrock, I have the microphone now. I've been many places in Europe, Asia, and South America. And even as long ago as 1980, the best thing way to solve the restroom problem is to find a McDonald's. The locals don't know about it, and you can just walk in, and so there you are. And anyway, The most memorable experience of my life was the semester I spent in Brazil as a senior Fulbright lecturer in the third largest city in the country, because I was there long enough to integrate into the culture. And it was at a time, it's a time when I needed it. I was separated from my first wife, and I was pretty much on the rocks. And I got out of town for many months and went to visit a foreign culture and really threw myself into it. And my students and the faculty at the Federal University where I taught always told me, we hate Americans, but we don't hate you because you're different. You're trying to learn the language, you'll eat the food, you live in the culture, and you're just different, and I really appreciated that. But I got along very well there. Traveling this last couple of weeks, the place where I lived, Belo Horizonte, has been in the news for massive riots. BH, as it is called, my own initials, is pronounced Bahia in Portuguese being described as a pig trying to sing for his dinner or something like that. Written very much like Spanish, but listening to it, it is really very different than Spanish. But I tried to learn it, and I survived on the economy. Well, probably the most memorable experience was going to Ouro Preto, which is a world historical site, the colonial capital of Minas Gerais, where I lived, and trying to find Preparado Agá. Well, you think about that a minute. Agá means H, and well, anyway, it was a profound experience. They accepted me. Some of the faculty pointed out, boy, you really look different. They can spot you in a minute that you're an American. I said, why is that? And they said, well, you don't have pockets. You have pockets on your shirts. We don't have pockets on our shirts. But very heavily multicultural. And as one of my language teacher told me, she said, despite the reputation of Brazil as being a totally colorblind society, if you're black, poor, or ugly, you have no place in this society. Well, she was all three and was very bitter about her country. So things are not always what they seem, and you're very fortunate if you can learn a whole lot about a culture, because it'll stick with you the rest of your life.
Hi, Sybil Perkins. When I was growing up, my parents always hosted exchange students or exchange teachers, and so there were always extra bodies in our home from different cultures, and we got to learn about that. It was a wonderful way to grow up, and I think made me more open to international experiences. Now, I've lived in Europe and Central America, but I want to talk about my experience living in the Philippines. What I went to when I was 15 years old. Of course, there was no there were no cell phones. There really wasn't even landline phone service in the town that I was in, and no TV and no internet, of course. But I was in a very rural town and didn't really know what I was getting into. A huge culture shock. The very first morning I walked down and they had put out this huge spread of food, and I took one look at it and smelled it and threw up all over their patio. And so I had a lot of getting used to things to get used to. One thing that was very, very difficult for me as an American teenager was I was expected to bow and kiss the hands of anyone that was older than me. That took me a long time to feel comfortable with, but I eventually did. I eventually assimilated into that, and it felt natural after I was there for a while. But while I was there, I went to high school, and it was such an incredibly different experience. We had to pay for it. We had to wear a uniform. I was the only white female that anyone in town had seen other than Julie Andrews at the movies in Sound of America, Sound of Music. And so people who didn't know me would call me Julie or Joe, because that's what the American soldiers were called in World War II. But the school had no glass in the windows. There were parts of it were rubble that had been bombed during the war. There were times when we sat in water up to our waists in class during the rainy season. We'd sit on stools, and it was a little disconcerting seeing snakes go by my. But you know, you got used to it. So when it would rain, you'd have to have the umbrella up by near the window to keep the rain off your papers. And the students were responsible for staying after school and cleaning. There were no custodians. We cleaned that facility, and it was beautiful. PE consisted of rice farming the paddies, which I always suspected put money in the principal's pocket, but of course I never said that out loud. The going to high school was an incredible privilege there. Very few people got to be there, even in those conditions that we think are so inferior to our educational system. That was a primo education there. People that were there were very, very grateful to be there. And so the effect on me when I came, I was so assimilated after being there a year, only speaking Tagalog, that I had a hard time assimilating when I got back to the States. And I felt really out of place as an American teenager when I got back. I was so angry at how much everyone took for granted and how they treated their school, how they skipped class, wasn't important. Anyway, it really instilled upon me the value of an education and how lucky we are. And I think that probably is the reason why I was the first person in my family to get a college education.
Hi, I'm Diane Barker, and I was very, very blessed to be able to live outside Tokyo from the time I was 8 till I was 12. So this was 1960 to 1964, and the Vietnam War was already going. I didn't know that at the time, but my dad would go over to Saigon and spell people so they could go get their R&R, and he'd just say, well, I'm going to Saigon, and we didn't know what was going on. And we would have, you know, I mean, you're white, you're privileged. We had a maid. We were given instructions how to deal with help, because if you've never had servants, you don't know how to treat them. You know, as I think of upstairs, downstairs, you're schooled in don't be too familiar. You have to have certain rules. It's very confusing because, you know, we're all freedom seekers, and we believe in equality. Okay, but the story that I wanted to tell you was I watched our Japanese bus driver struggle with a situation where a lot of demonstrations had started, and these demonstrations were so violent that we couldn't go to school. We had to leave Grant Heights on these big brown school buses and get bused across town to Camp Drake. Well, we couldn't go to school for about a week. We would drive up to the gates, and here were all these Japanese people in red bandanas with Yankee Go Home banners screaming, "Yankee Go Home." And I would go home and say to my dad, "Why don't we go home?" You know, and we would have college students who would come to the house. This wasn't during this particularly violent time, but on either side of this big demonstration time, and they would tell us, "Please do have Japanese college students come to your home, but don't talk about religion and don't talk about politics." Well, what else do people want to talk about? You know, they don't want to talk about what shoes they're wearing and stuff like that. And that ended badly. The students and my dad got in a big argument, and the students never came back, and my dad didn't really want them to come back anyway. So I'm on the school bus, and I'm watching this crowd that's pressed up against the gates. They couldn't even get the gates open. Well, they got them open for a while, and then they would shut them. We went through this for about 3 days, I guess. And the driver impressed me because he wanted to take these American kids to school. He wanted to do his job. And he was angry with his countrymen out there protesting. And I also know that he knew a lot of their protest was justified. And I could see, you know, I'm just a child, but actually really children don't have the filters on, so they do see things. And I saw that man struggling monumentally with who he was and what, where he had to be, which side of the fence was he going to be on? Was he going to continue to be a bus driver, or was he going to join the people on the other side of the gate?
Ann Cowan, before I left to go to Nicaragua for a while, Dr. Leland writes, and I don't know if any of you remember him, I think he's practicing in Wamego now, but he had his first serious non-physical therapy conversation with me when he called me aside, and he's had a lot of experience from his work in Vietnam. After he was in the military, he went back and established, I believe, an orphanage, but he wanted to give me a talking to, and I don't know if it was because he would have anyone or because he knew me and I needed a talking to, but he told me, do not go there with the idea that you have the answers for any of their problems, that you have a better way of doing things, and that because they are done differently or because they're having problems with things, he said, do not assume you have the answer. And one thing I haven't heard you all mention is that one thing I really learned living abroad was what I learned about the United States, seeing the United States from an outside view. I realized things that I hadn't thought about before. The things that made the newspaper and made the comments while I was living in Nicaragua, I remember the talk on the streets when someone in Pennsylvania someplace was put to death by the death penalty. They thought that was really big news. What a horrible thing to have happened here in the United States, that it would never happen there. You know, and things like that, that they were very aware of. And the children, the young people, knew so much about the United States. They all could find the United States on a map. They could find Kansas on a map. When you said Kansas, they knew about people in Kansas, and it was not Dorothy. It was George Brett. They knew more about George Brett than I would ever know. They knew more about Bob Dole. They knew in their own country, they knew how their government was run, right down to the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of Treasury. A 7-year-old could name the Secretary of Treasury down there. And they would ask me questions like that, and I would say, I don't know who it is right now. But it was interesting to learn about the United States from someone else's view.
Thank you. We encourage, one more. Go ahead.
Hi, Aaron Estabrook. I kind of new to this, but I also wanted to share one of the biggest impacts in my life was having an opportunity to study abroad through Israel, or through K-State in Israel for 6 months in Cyprus, and study conflict resolution and from an academic and be completely immersed in that culture, and then go to war in Afghanistan. And from both of those perspectives, the one thing that I don't know anyone really touched on was the way children are very much similar, curious, and can be taught at a very early level. And they learn from us and the way that we approach life and our cultures. And they all start out the same. The boy in Afghanistan, or the girl running around in Afghanistan that's, you know, 5 or 6 and just curious and wants to know everything, is the same as the boy in Jerusalem, or, you know, a kid in Kansas. So it's really, that's the takeaway I got from seeing those different areas and those different cultures. And we kind of get stuck in our society and our norms and everything. But when we look at the kids, there really is a comparison all the way across.
Yeah, I think there's a song that goes something along the lines of, you have to be carefully taught, that addresses what you just mentioned. I thank you for sharing your experiences, and I hope that you're able to continue these outside as we share in coffee and conversation afterwards. We're going to try something a little different for our closing song. We're going to be listening to a video from Playing for Change and singing along. It's written as a chorus, but it pops up very often during the song. So the words to the chorus are written on the program. Playing for Change is a foundation that has been in existence for about a decade. Its mission is fairly simple, but its goals are enormous. Playing for Change is dedicated to connecting the world through music. By providing musicians, or providing resources to musicians and their communities throughout the world. So please enjoy, and as the Spirit moves you, jump, dance, sway, but sing along with the closing song. Thanks, all of you. That's number 72 of the videos. There are 71 on one side and another 6 or 7 on the other side if you're interested in going to the Playing for Change website. John Donne wrote about 400 years ago, a long time ago, that no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. So part of the global family, let us now all go into the world with open eyes and open hearts. Thank you.